The concept of Flight Bridge Ed was sparked when a growing need and a dream united into an idea. That idea grew into a passion, and from passion came a global community of providers and students joining in the revolution of pre-hospital, critical care, and emergency medicine education. Now, from around the world, we are calling our community together. We are proud to announce the Flight Bridge Ed Air and Surface Transport Symposium in Nashville, Tennessee on March 20th and 21st, 2018. World-class speakers, vendors, and of course, the Flight Bridge Ed team will be there. Go to our website now to register. Join the revolution. The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and Flight Bridge Ed in their entirety. This is the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric back with you. Today we're going to do a podcast on a topic that we've never covered, and I think it's important to look at things from a more in-depth physiology and kind of go back to the basics. Before we start, I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and happy holiday season. I want to thank everybody for an amazing year. We have surpassed any expectation, and we truly are grateful and humbled that you chose us to partner with and that we were there to assist you in your education, your test taking, and to be able to experience with you your success. So we want to thank you for all the kind emails and just for the constant support, and just know that we're going to continue to walk alongside you. All right, so let's get started. This podcast, as I said, is going to be actually dedicated to two buddies of mine, Tyler Cristofoli and Sam Ireland. These are two great critical care educators, and this is a topic that they both love. And I thought, why not do a podcast on this? So we're going to specifically look at pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics, and plasma protein binding. And if you're saying, oh my gosh, it's not going to be that bad, but I think it's very, very interesting, and I think we have to understand to this level what's happening when we give a medication. Are we given a medication based on an IV administration route, or are we giving it sublingually? Are we giving it by mouth? All of that plays a big, big role in absorption and what's called systemic metabolism versus first-pass metabolism. And then we're going to get into our overall, how does this medication absorb? What goes into the absorption aspect? So pharmacokinetics, that's the movement of that medication. And when we think about the dynamics, pharmacodynamics, that's the power of the medication. How does that medication act on the receptors? So let's kind of get started. Number one, absorption of that medication. Remember absorption, if you think back to your education to paramedic school, nursing school, essentially the transfer of that drug based on the site of administration and how that medication gets to the bloodstream, that's the absorption. And that absorption is going to be based on the route. It's going to be based on the dose. It's going to be based on lipid solubility. And so based on the route, the dose, and the solubility of that medication, that's going to kind of play into how that medication is going to affect our patients. So the last one that we talked about just briefly was lipid solubility. How does that medication dissolve? How does it get taken up by that cell? Well, as I said, absorption is based on the route, it's based on the dose, and it's based on the lipid solubility. Well, if we think back to a cell membrane, cell membranes are double phospholipid chain cell membranes, meaning that they have a double fat layer. A great analogy is think about an Oreo cookie. And that Oreo cookie, the wafer part, that's going to be that phospholipid. And the chain, that little area in the middle, right, that creamy center of that Oreo, that is that middle fat layer. You could also think of this as two balloons. And so if we had a balloon laying on a table and you had one balloon facing to the right and that balloon had a streamer on it, and then you had another balloon to the left, and so it's facing opposite, and you had the streamers kind of connected, that's kind of how a cell membrane looks, a double phospholipid cell membrane. And so medications are vastly lipid soluble, meaning that these drug companies understand that the cell membrane, being fat, made of fat, being that double phospholipid layer, medications are going to be able to diffuse through that phospholipid layer if they're fat soluble. So that kind of takes us to three concepts. The first concept is a definition or a word called lipophilic. A lipophilic medication means that that medication is fat loving, means that it's highly lipid soluble. So that's important for that medication to be highly lipid soluble. Number two, hydrophilic, meaning that that medication is water soluble. Now, there's not a lot of medications that are water soluble, because water soluble medications are not going to be able to diffuse through that double phospholipid cell membrane. So you don't see medications that are water soluble most often. And then the last one is called hydrophobic. Hydrophobic medications, or the term hydrophobic, means resistant or to repel water. So these medications have poor absorption, and they need what's called an aqueous solution to be transported in to transport through or diffuse through that cell membrane. Now, it's important to understand that that's the whole aspect of absorption. And then we get into the distribution side of things. And distribution, the biggest aspect of distributing that medication is what's called plasma protein binding. And that was the number three part of our title of this podcast. So plasma proteins, when we think about plasma proteins, we have two specific plasma proteins that we see triggered or bound to. And the first one and the most dominant one is albumin. And we've talked about albumin in many podcasts. We know albumin is a weak acid. So albumin being acidic is going to be the primary binding site for medications. Medications are made to be kind of acidic, to where they want to bind with that acidic protein. Now, we do have another plasma protein, that secondary plasma protein, and we actually have multiple plasma proteins, but our two primary ones we're going to focus on that are the dominant ones that are utilized by our body is going to be, number one, that albumin, as we said, was acidic. And number two, a plasma protein that's an alpha-1 acid glycoprotein. Now, that's a basic or alkalotic plasma protein. So that is your binding site location. As I said, the number one binding site is going to be albumin. And we're going to come back to specifically looking at plasma protein binding. So we've talked about absorption briefly. We've talked about distribution briefly. Now let's briefly kind of touch on metabolism, or you could also say metabolism is the start of elimination. Essentially what happens is your liver starts breaking down that medication. And a great analogy would be, imagine we have a medication. Medication is drug A. And we'll say that medication is the parent medication. Well, based on that parent medication, the metabolism starts and it breaks down that parent medication into drug B. And we'll say drug B is now the daughter medication of drug A. And essentially, by doing that, the polarity, the charges change. And that optimizes and allows our body to excrete that medication. And that's where you kind of look at metabolism and elimination together. As we said, the whole metabolism aspect is also based on plasma drug binding, and we're going to get to that. So let's look at metabolism a little bit more in depth. So metabolism, we said, is primarily going to happen in our liver. Our liver is so important to metabolizing medications, to get rid of these waste products. And we have two types of metabolism. We have what's called systemic metabolism, meaning that the blood flow, if we gave a medication via IV, that medication is going to enter that bloodstream immediately. It's going to go through our heart, and then it's going to enter the liver. The other type of metabolism is called first pass metabolism. That's the type of metabolism we see when we give a medication based on a PO route. In that context, it doesn't get to go through the heart. It doesn't get to go through our bloodstream. It immediately gets absorbed through our intestinal wall. It enters the portal vein and it enters into our liver. And so you have first pass metabolism, and then it exits and enters our bloodstream. And so we're going to go through that. The liver is really cool. It's pretty amazing. And we have to know that the liver is built for two separate blood supplies. So you have a systemic blood supply where that liver leaves the inferior vena cava. That blood leaves that inferior vena cava, enters via the aorta, goes into the celiac artery, and then into the common hepatic artery, and then it moves through that system. If we compare that to, as I said, the first pass metabolism, if we take a medication in by mouth or even giving a medication rectally, that absorption is going to happen through the intestinal wall, and then that medication is going to be transported to the liver immediately through the portal vein. It's going to go through the metabolism aspect. So, for example, if you think about a medication given PO versus IV, we always know a PO medication is always much higher. I mean, we see PO morphine given at 10 milligrams or more. You're not going to give a big 10 milligram dose IV of morphine. It's because of first pass metabolism. So if we give a medication PO, we give a medication rectally, we have to understand that that medication dose has to be probably double what it would be IV wise, because it's going to immediately go through that absorption through that intestinal wall into the portal vein, into the liver, and then based on its metabolism through that liver, each medication is classified. If it's 50% metabolized by the liver, then you're going to lose half of that medication immediately through what's called first pass metabolism. So that's why we see those higher doses given PO or rectally. Now, if we kind of reverse track and we go back to IV administration, because it's going directly into that bloodstream, it's not moving to the liver immediately. It's going through our bloodstream where we have immediate plasma protein binding. We're going to get into how all that works here in a second. And then we see the medication triggering our receptors. And then it finally reaches our liver through that celiac artery and into the common hepatic artery. And then it gets into the liver that way. And we start metabolizing the medication for overall elimination and excretion. So administration through the PO route, through the rectal route, we know is going to have first pass metabolism. We always have to have that in the back of our mind. In contrast, if we give it IV, if we give it IM, if we give it sub-Q, that medication is actually going to go into the systemic metabolism. Whether we give it IM or sub-Q or even sublingual, that medication is going to absorb into our little capillaries and it's going to enter into our bloodstream that way. It's not going to enter our liver first. So based on that concept, that's where we get into what's called bioavailability. And bioavailability means that what's the amount of medication available in the plasma based on the concentration. So as I said, if we give an IV dose of a medication, our bioavailability is going to be 100%. If we give it sublingual, if we give it IM, it's going to move through the capillaries into the heart, right, into the systemic bloodstream. And so your bioavailability is 100%. In contrast, if we think about PO, our bioavailability is going to drop all the way down to 10% and move up to 50%. It's going to be much, much smaller, again, because of that first pass metabolism. Now let's get into our plasma protein binding. Very important part of this whole process. So let's say we have these little balls, these little beach balls I want you to imagine those little beach balls, and each little beach ball has six little seats. So we have six little compartments. And each one of those beach balls will say are albumin proteins. So we have six little seats. We give a medication. The plasma protein binding of that medication is going to be based on the percentage. And so certain medications have a high plasma protein binding affinity. Other medications have a very low plasma protein binding affinity. If we consider, let's say, a medication like Dilantin and a medication like Coumadin. Dilantin and Coumadin have both a very high plasma protein binding ability, like 99%. Each one of them are 99%. So let's say your patient is on Coumadin and they're also on Dilantin. And that patient is going to have some type of procedure. So they remove that Coumadin from the patient's drug regimen. They reduce that dose, right? They may change them to Lovenox or something like that. What happens? Well, if we have those beach balls and we give Dilantin, and Dilantin is 99% plasma protein binding, what we're saying is that the medication is going to flood all of those empty seats, all those little seats on those albumin proteins. Imagine those albumin proteins as little sponges, and they're going to absorb all those medication molecules. Then we give Coumadin. Well, what happens is that Coumadin is also 99% plasma protein binding. And so it's going to actually displace and cause an equilibrium to where if we had six seats and we had four different proteins, just for an example, right? Obviously, we have billions of proteins, but if we had four little proteins and you had six seats at each one, that's 24 total seats. Well, if we started out with Dilantin and you flooded the system and you filled up all those receptors, now you have full plasma protein binding, and then we give Coumadin, you're going to have equality because they have the equal amount of plasma protein binding ability. Now you're going to have 12 seats occupied by Dilantin and 12 seats occupied by Coumadin. Well, how is that important? Because essentially when we give a medication, any medication, as I said, and I'm going to go through each medication that we kind of give on a standard, call volume wise. If we give a medication and that medication has a high plasma protein binding ability, and you give another medication that has a high plasma protein binding ability, those medications are going to potentiate. Well, how does that happen? Well, what did we see there? We saw that when we gave Dilantin by itself, we filled all those receptors. Well, what happens to once those receptors are all filled? Well, the interesting thing is that once those receptors are all filled, imagine a sponge that's completely saturated. It cannot absorb any more water. The excess water is going to just be running out. Well, it's exactly what happens to the medication. Once we fill all those receptors, the medication left over, that's what's available to our body in our plasma, what's free in our plasma for receptor targeting, meaning, whatever the medication is used for, if we're giving a narcotic, if we're giving a benzo. So what's ever bound to protein is not available for use, whatever is excess. So that's where dose comes into play. And obviously researchers, drug companies have figured out how much of a dose we need to give to cause full plasma protein binding to where then you have excess in the plasma that we can utilize for receptor targeting. Well, how does this work? Well, imagine if we had this patient where we stopped the Coumadin, what's going to happen? So we had an equal amount of seats filled. We had 12 seats filled with Dilantin and we had 12 seats filled with Coumadin. And obviously we had excess that was in our plasma. And so we were maintaining a good INR. We were maintaining a good seizure threshold. Well, then we took our Coumadin away. So if we took our Coumadin dose and lowered it or took it away altogether, for example, and we switch to another medication that may have a very poor plasma protein binding, what's going to happen? Well, then the receptors that were filled, those protein receptors that were filled, are now not filled with Coumadin anymore. Well, what happens to those empty receptors? Well, we have this dilantin that's floating free in our plasma. And so it's going to be kind of sucked into, as a sponge would, sucked into those empty receptors. So remember, anything floating free, that dilantin that was floating free, that was what was being utilized for therapeutic targeting of receptors, obviously to lower this patient's seizure threshold. Well, now if that sponge, if that albumin protein is now sucking all those excess dilantin drug molecules up, what's available for that patient's seizure threshold? And so what happens a lot of times, if you don't understand this, if a physician said, yes, stop your Coumadin, they didn't realize they were on dilantin, or maybe they forgot, or, you know, this happens, it's very common. Patient could have a seizure at this point, right? Could be a day or two later, but because now the medication that was free in the plasma is now bound to plasma proteins, we don't have that therapeutic kind of index. And so whatever's free in that plasma is not available to target those receptors. So what would need to happen in this situation is if the Coumadin got deleted from this drug regimen, the dilantin dose would have to be increased. And hopefully that makes sense. So how does that play into what we do? Essentially, remember, drug dosing is based on the total amount to fully saturate the plasma protein receptors. So there's available drug, essentially free to activate the receptors. And that's where we have to kind of understand what medications that we give have a very high plasma protein binding ability. The higher the plasma protein binding ability, the bigger issues we may see when we give another medication in conjunction that has the same amount of plasma protein binding. So, for example, fentanyl. Fentanyl has an 80 to 85% plasma protein binding ability. And if you compare fentanyl with morphine, morphine only has 30%. So morphine is not going to be displaced or will not displace another medication like fentanyl would. If you gave fentanyl, which is 85%, and you gave it in conjunction with a benzo, benzodiazepines are anywhere from 95 to 98% plasma protein binding. So if you think about Versed, and this is the kind of the big teaching point here, Versed has a 97% plasma protein binding ability. Fentanyl has 85%. So what happens? And we see this all the time. We'll be given fentanyl, and obviously the dosing regimen that we use in our setting has already been identified through these drug manufacturers. They've figured out how much drug you need to give. And so we give our fentanyl, we're giving 100 mics, and we decide, hey, we're going to give 2.5 milligrams of Versed. Well, fentanyl has an 85% plasma protein binding, and so all those albumin proteins are flooded and filled. Remember, that sponge is completely saturated, and whatever's excess in that plasma, floating around in that plasma, that's what's triggering those pain receptors. Then we give Versed, and Versed has a 95 to 98%, we'll just kind of make it in that range, plasma protein binding ability. So it's going to displace fentanyl off of that albumin plasma protein, right? Obviously, we have billions of them. And you're going to have more fentanyl now into the free plasma, which is now available for receptor targeting. You're also going to have the same issue with Versed. It's going to take a smaller amount of Versed to fill those plasma protein receptor sites. And so you're going to have more Versed in our plasma, free plasma, for targeting of those receptors. And you may see this in reverse, right? Where you're giving Versed and you haven't started pain management, and Versed has a higher plasma protein binding affinity than fentanyl. And so you would have all those plasma proteins flooded and filled, that sponge is full. And then you give a small dose of fentanyl, 100 mics. And what happens? Well, you're going to have a bigger potentiation because now your fentanyl is displacing more Versed from those receptors. The Versed now is dumping into our free plasma where it can be utilized by those receptors. And so that's where you may see a drop in mentation. You may see a bigger drop in hemodynamic status. And so this really does affect our patients in a negative way, or it can if you're not kind of understanding this to this level. This is what we see. We just may not have understood kind of the physiology. So as I said, other medications may have a different plasma protein binding affinity. As I said, benzos, 95 to 97%. So specifically, Versed is 97%. We know Versed has a very rapid onset and shorter duration when you compare that to Valium. Valium has a slower onset due to the less ability to diffuse through those lipids. So it has a less lipid-soluble ability compared to Versed or Ativan. But its plasma protein binding ability is actually 98%. Then when you can compare your Versed and your Valium to Ativan, you know, Ativan is a medication that I often don't ever think about. But really, in doing some of this research for this podcast, I've realized that Ativan is the medication you would want to use in patients that have any liver dysfunction, any ability to metabolize that medication. So Ativan is always your go-to benzo-wise if your patient's in liver failure or has a liver injury, anything like that, go Ativan. When we think about medications that we give for induction in RSI, etomidate versus ketamine. Well, etomidate has a 76% ability to bind with plasma. Ketamine has a 47%. And that's one reason why we may not see the big potentiation when we give ketamine and fentanyl, is because ketamine has a much lower binding affinity than fentanyl does. When you compare ketamine at 47% and Versed at 97%, right? Versed and fentanyl are very, very high binding. They're going to potentiate each other. They're going to knock each other off of those receptor sites to where you're going to have more free drug in that plasma. You're going to have a bigger response receptor-wise. Ketamine is 47%, so that's where ketamine may be a little safer in those hemodynamically unstable patients. And obviously, we've talked about ketamine in other podcasts that we need to lower that dose when we have a patient that is in a high shock index state. The last kind of medication concept I want to kind of discuss before we wrap this up is think about medications like ACE inhibitors and angiotensin II blocking agents. And this is something I've talked about in the review classes and something that I think we may see a change in our industry in the next 5 years. And anesthesiologists, they already understand this. They already pre-screen their patients for this. They already try to eliminate this risk. But if you think about a patient on an ACE inhibitor, we know ACE inhibitors are targeting that ACE receptor in our lung. We know that ACE enzyme converts and turns into angiotensin 1, which converts to angiotensin 2, and that's our primary regulation of blood pressure. And then we have medications like angiotensin 2 blocking agents or ARB medications, but either one of these medications have a high affinity for plasma protein binding. ACE inhibitors are 99% bound to plasma proteins. Angiotensin 2 blocking agents, ARBs, 95 to 100%, depending on the medication that they're prescribed. So how does this play into our patients? Well, as I said, anesthesiologists, they understand that medications like ACE inhibitors and ARBs pose kind of a lethal cocktail. And if you give these patients a medication like etomidate or a bigger dose of propofol, or you give them, a benzo, what you'll have likely is you're going to have this, obviously, equilibrium. You have all this ACE inhibitor that's bound to these plasma protein sites. They have this therapeutic dose now that's free in the plasma. And now we flood their system with another medication that has a high binding affinity, like, let's say, Versed. Well, what's going to happen? The Versed is going to cause an equilibrium. It's going to displace ACE inhibitor, that ACE inhibitor medication off of those plasma protein binding sites. So use the analogy. We have four different receptors, just to make it simple. Each receptor has six sites. Imagine we have all 24 sites, six times four is 24. All 24 sites are filled with an ACE inhibitor medication, receptor, or medication molecule. And then we give Versed. What's going to happen? It's going to cause an equilibrium because they both have the essentially the same affinity for plasma proteins. So you're going to displace 12 of those ACE inhibitor medication molecules. And those molecules are now going to be put into the bloodstream, right? Into the plasma, the free plasma, where we can now see that medication utilized, its action kind of triggered. And so what you have is now you have Versed that has filled those other 12 sites. Now it has taken less medication to fill all of those plasma sites for Versed, and now we have a larger dose in our system that's free to be utilized as far as receptor triggering. And so hopefully you're kind of able to see what I'm saying, what I'm kind of talking about is now we have a larger amount of ACE inhibitor in our plasma. We have a larger amount of benzo, Versed in our plasma, and you're going to have a precipitous drop in blood pressure. Your patient is going to respond in a negative way. And so now, you know, this doesn't always happen to every single patient, but it's enough of a risk that anesthesiologists will look at patients that are on ACE inhibitors, on ARB medications, and they'll automatically give them a push dose pressor. A lot of times, if they're on an ACE inhibitor or ARB, they'll actually use vasopressin as their push dose pressor. I've talked about this many times at our review courses that they'll give 2 to 4 units IV push of vasopressin. They also use caffeine. They may use ephedra, you know, but they don't always go epi. They don't always go neo as their push dose pressor. A lot of times they're using vasopressin in this context. And they do that because they know the potentiation based on the ACE inhibitor and ARB and how those other medications that we give for induction, how they're going to trigger that receptor site, how those medications are going to now be free in our plasma. So that same mindset, we need to also kind of bring that mindset into our environment because we deal with these same types of patients. Now, I know it's a little bit more difficult to identify sometimes the medications that they're on. And so, you know, that's something we have to hopefully be able to identify, but we should always kind of consider those things. When we think about your paralytic medications, succinylcholine, for example, has a 0% of binding ability. So it does not bind with plasma proteins. Rocuronium actually has a 30% binding affinity. So we really don't have to worry about anything with regards to our paralytics. It's mainly how does our narcotics, as we said, fentanyl is about 85%, morphine is about 30%. So big difference. Demerol, right? We don't usually use Demerol in our setting. We see it used in the hospital setting. It has up to an 80% plasma protein binding ability. But if you use Demerol in the context of PO, you're going to lose 60% of that medication based on that first pass metabolism. So anytime we give a PO dose, remember, you're going to lose a huge, huge majority of that medication automatically based on it traveling through the intestinal wall into that portal vein, into the liver, and then it's metabolized. And then we get whatever's left over into the bloodstream, exits out the inferior vena cava, comes in through the heart into our systemic system, and that's how those receptors are then triggered based on first that ability to bind with plasma proteins, and then whatever's excess in the plasma, that's what we see triggering those receptors. So hopefully this podcast has kind of shed some light on how does our medications, how do they work? What plays into bigger doses versus smaller doses? How can one medication administered by themselves, how can that action change when we add another medication? So understanding the medications and their binding ability, their ability to metabolize. I think majority of medications from my research, the majority are metabolized in the liver, and the majority are all excreted primarily out of the urine. So think about patients that are in renal failure, that are in liver failure or have a compromised renal or liver metabolism system? How are those patients going to respond? Remember, benzodiazepines, etomidate, dilantin, all those medications have a byproduct of propylene glycol. And so based on their ability to metabolize in the liver and being highly metabolized in the liver, if you have a dysfunctional system, if your liver cannot get rid of it, if your kidneys are not working appropriately, that's where you start seeing these patients become toxic and they become glycol toxic, so propylene glycol toxic. And that's simply because of a buildup of medications like benzos, etomidate, dilantin, things like that. So as I said, hopefully this kind of answers some questions, or maybe it just turned on some light bulbs. Maybe this is something you want to research more. If you have any questions, just feel free to email me at eric.bauer@flatbridget.com. As I said, I wanted to dedicate this to Tyler and Sam. Hopefully they enjoyed this. And until next time, I will talk to you soon.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.